Hello! Welcome again to the Rotten Horror Picture Show, the horror movie podcast where we talk about films off the Rotten Tomatoes 200 Best Horror Movies of All Time list. My name is Clay. With me, as always, is Amanda. How are you doing, Amanda?
I'm doing well. I'm here in a big weird coat. I've got a flower arrangement. Take me to the cemetery.
Listen.
Yeah?
Don't use your pickup lines on me. I know that's what it says on your Hinge profile for dream first date.
That's just a normal Saturday for me.
The movie we're talking about today is an oddity because for a couple reasons. One, it's probably the shortest movie we've ever covered because it was only like 3 minutes long. And two, I was not expecting Billy Idol
God damn it.
To be in this movie.
For a split second there, I was so confused because I was like, I'm pretty sure we've done movies that are like 74 minutes long. This one is like over an hour and a half. I don't know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Almost got me.
Yeah. You know, you said you've been singing, humming that song.
Yes.
Billy Idol's Eyes Without a Face. Mm-hmm. I have as well, but incorrectly.
Oh.
I've been smushing two of them together because I realized I don't actually know what like the verses of Eyes Without a Face sound like.
No.
So I'm in my head hearing the chorus, Eyes Without a Face, and then the rest of it is the lyrics to Flesh for Fantasy, which I don't know if you know that Billy Idol song, but
I don't think I do.
It's weird.
But I do love that you are not only mashing up two songs, but two Billy Idol songs.
I had a brief period where I was really into Billy Idol when I was like, I want to say like late high school.
Can see that.
And when I say really into, it means I bought one greatest hits CD that I listened to a lot. It was in that era where I was like, I had listened to the radio, as kids used to do.
Yes. The ancient rite of listening to the radio.
And I was in that era where I found out that this people who did the songs I heard on the radio had other music.
Yeah.
And some of that music was pretty good.
Right, right. That not every single song from the CD was or album was going to make it onto the radio.
Right.
And so you might have to go seek out other material that might also be good.
Yeah. It was quite an enlightening era for me because it was basically I was when I was working in the summer, the money that a big chunk of the money that I got, I'd immediately go to Newbery Comics and start rifling through the Wicked Cheap CD bin,
which
was like $10 or $8 or something. And so I'd be grabbing the stuff that I probably wouldn't normally get, and it was all excellent.
Nice.
That's the only way I was going to buy a best of Barry White.
Oh.
Do not regret.
Yeah.
Fantastic CD.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're talking about Eyes Without a Face.
The Billy Idol smash hit.
Yes. I was very excited when I was on vacation with my parents once because we were in some whatever store. And in the like 25-cent CD bin, I found a copy of Billy Idol's, I think it's called Cyberpunk.
Oh.
Which is a late era, when I say late era, I'm talking like early 90s Billy Idol album that is notoriously bad.
Oh.
But it's when he tried to like shift gears into like techno.
Oh boy.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Oof. But at the time I was like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
I'm going to put it in the sleeve next to the Judge Dredd soundtrack. Anyway.
Yes.
Eyes Without a Face from 1960. This is number 20 on our list with a 97% Rotten Tomatoes score, an 87% audience score. Had you seen this before?
I had. I feel like this is one of those movies that maybe not early on in like streaming, but like early on when I had streaming.
Yeah.
Because there was a period where streaming was very normal for other people to have, but I was broke.
Do you remember the very early days of streaming when it was like just Netflix?
Yes.
And it was all time-based?
Okay, no.
So it was like, if you paid like $10 a month for whatever the base level plan was, you got like 10 hours of streaming or something like that.
Oh, wow.
A month. Yeah.
No.
So I remember I was, the only thing that I was watching at the time was The Office and Monty Python. And so I was just like trucking through my 10 hour chunk real fast. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, I feel like this was one of those movies that I like stumbled on.
Mm-hmm.
Either on a streaming platform way back, or even probably on YouTube when it was easier to just like find an entire movie.
Yeah.
On YouTube.
Just that casually searching for French movies on YouTube.
Or just like there was just a more limited amount of shit on YouTube.
Yeah.
And so things like this would surface to you a little quicker. And I remember watching it like on the janky screen of my laptop and being like, this might be the most beautiful movie I've ever seen.
I think that the early days of YouTube, I don't know what's better, honestly, the early days or now, because the early days, there was way less, like, companies and stuff didn't know what it was.
Right.
So you could find all this copyrighted material or whatever, and, you know, don't pirate, kids, but, you know, YouTube is fine. But then obviously they figured it out and they started cracking down on that. But still now you can go to YouTube and find tons of shit. It's not great for looking for above board stuff, but if you're looking for something that's a little weird or like a little less obvious, you can probably find it. You can find full movies.
Yeah.
I think it's really great for concerts. Like, there are so many concerts, concert videos that weren't like released or whatever, or it's really great for concerts.
I had not thought of that.
Yeah, you can go and type in a band you like and find like a full 2-hour set.
Yeah.
It's pretty great.
You can also find deep dives on your weird niche content.
That too.
Yes.
Yeah, I was learning about female Muay Thai fighters the other day.
I was learning about Kernanos.
Excuse me?
Don't worry about it. Anyway.
Kernanus?
Yeah, more or less. Ancient god. They're not really sure what his whole deal was. Kind of one of those like mythological mysteries.
Ah, like Zardoz.
No. Moving on.
Anyway. I had seen this. I'd only seen this once before. I think this was to reference Netflix yet again, for no money on our end. I think this was in that pocket where I was just going through lists of great movies and great horror movies.
Yep.
And I was getting into the more off the beaten path stuff. And this was definitely one of those. Mm. There's another one from around this era, and I cannot remember it, but I used to get them mixed up. But she had a face in that one. So I don't remember what it was called.
Eyes with a Face.
Yeah. But this was another one where it's like, made quite an impression on me, even though I never went back and watched it again. However, every time a Blu-ray sale pops up, this is one of those I'm like, ooh, I should get that. And then the other part of my brain says, Clay, you haven't watched that movie in 20 years. Do you really need to own it?
One of those movies where when I have watched it, it's like very enchanting. Do you know what I mean? Like the experience of sitting and watching it, letting it kind of wash over you, like visually and like sinking into the sort of strange dreamy world it happens in is really great. But then I always think to myself, like, how often are you gonna really rewatch this?
Yeah.
Like, what, how many times a year do you think I'm gonna throw on Eyes Without a Face?
I mean, that has never stopped me before, but
it's starting to stop me now. Just
it should
for
stop me.
Space constraints.
Yeah.
And for my poor husband who is drowning in folk horror Blu-rays.
Yeah.
So
I've actually, I've gone like a step past this now where I'm not buying these things that it's like, oh, I remember liking that. Maybe I'll get that and put it in my collection. I'm just jumping right into stuff I've never even seen.
So you've kind of reverted in a way. Cause that
kind
is
of
how we used to have to like buy DVDs.
Yeah.
A lot of times.
Yeah.
When pre-streaming, it was sort of, if you wanted to add some new stuff to your cabinet, a lot of times you had to just take a leap of faith.
Yeah. And I kind of, you know, I find it fun.
Yeah.
The only thing is, though, it is really, I think it's partially born from my want to explore and find out and find new things, but it is also partially born from giving me an excuse to buy it, which it's like, you know, a real Gollum and Schmeagle situation.
It's called a shopping addiction.
Yeah. It's called trying to fill a hole emotionally. But this is one where it's like, this is one where I could see some, like in college, mm-hmm. walking into someone's dorm room and like their roommates just chilling out on their bed, watching yeah. Eyes Without a Face.
High
and just
being as like, hell.
Okay. What is going on here?
I think I was doing that, except it was in my tiny closet of a room when I used to live in a house with a bunch of roommates.
Yeah.
And I would be on my laptop with the covers kind of pulled around me, watching Eyes Without a Face in the dark. And then one of my roommates would knock on the door and be like, hey, Amanda, do you have any... What is happening? And I'd just say nothing.
Was the rest of that sentence, hey, Amanda, do you have a therapy appointment coming up?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of wish I did that now.
What, scare your roommates? By
yeah, just I don't know. You fight. I ended up. I know I've mentioned this before, but my senior year of college, I due to probably no one's fault but my own, ended up doing 2 all-nighters a week for my first semester. And when I would lock in for an all-nighter, religiously every time, I would watch The Big Lebowski.
Oh.
And then follow that up with American Psycho.
Okay.
So I probably watched those 2 movies.
Getting 2 sides of the American experience.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I watched both of those movies, I don't know, probably 50 times. I don't know why it was those 2.
Hmm.
It just became the thing.
Yeah. Fair enough. I have like albums like that if I'm writing where there are certain, like if I'm like, I have to actually get work done.
Yeah.
There are like 2 albums I can put on and I am guaranteed to actually focus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard Stephen King or read him talk about how he, the way he writes is he puts on AC/DC really loud?
Yeah, yeah.
I just imagine.
Yeah,
like,
I love that.
I don't know how he gets stuff done with that.
I kind of get it. I feel like you must, after some point, it's almost just like it blanks out all of the like psychological noise in your head so that the only things that are going to carve through that are like real ideas.
Yeah.
Wait, did I do the laundry? Like it's hard to worry about like your taxes when AC/DC is really loud.
Yeah, I do kind of like the image though of in Stephen King's office. Behind that door is not him typing away, it's him duck walk air guitaring.
Yeah, yeah.
To Dirty Deeds and then going, ooh.
Yeah.
What if the car was a ghost?
Yeah. I bet that's actually pretty accurate. Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
What are we talking about? We're not talking about sequels, but if you want to listen to us talk about sequels, head over to patreon.com/thepenskyfile where we, Amanda and I are covering sequels this year. And the month of, what is this, March?
Yes.
Is going to be Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Which we are... very lucky to get to see in the theater as part of the Boston Underground Film Festival.
Yes.
Featuring an introduction by star Bill Moseley.
Yep.
So that'll be pretty fun. And then the next month will be, I almost said Fatal Attraction. Was it Final Destination 2?
Final Destination 2.
But anyway, we're going to play the trailer for you of Eyes Without a Face real quick and come back and talk about it.
Face to face, I'm back to back. You see and feel my sex attack.
Say it!
Flesh! Flesh for fantasy. We cry. Hey. Flesh! Flesh for fantasy.
Okay. Eyes Without a Face from 1960. Directed by George Franju. I don't know. Please, France, excuse me.
We're going to struggle through these names.
Written by, excuse me, written by Pierre Beaulieu and Thomas Narsajak, who apparently were authors who wrote the books that Les Diaboliques and Vertigo were based on.
Nice.
Jean Redon, Claude Sauté, based on the novel by Jean Redon, starring, oh boy, Pierre Brasseur, Alida Valli, Juliette Meniel, Alexander Regnault, Beatrice Altariba, Charles Blavet, and Edith Scob. That's a beautiful French name. Amanda, what happens in Eyes Without a Face?
Dr. Genesier is riddled with guilt after an accident that he caused disfigures the face of his daughter, the once beautiful Christiane, who outsiders now believe is dead. The doctor, along with an accomplice and laboratory assistant, Louise, kidnaps young women and brings them to the mansion. After rendering his victims unconscious, the doctor removes their faces and attempts to graft them onto Christiane.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a serviceable summary.
Yeah.
Well, Clay, some things you'll find in Eyes Without a Face include...
Mm-hmm.
I should have written faces. You'll find so many faces. Uber for corpses.
Yeah. It's a very interesting way to... it's a great start to the movie.
Yeah.
Music I wasn't expecting. But...
Yeah. It's a fantastic opening scene.
Yeah.
A conveniently located house/hospital in the middle of nowhere.
That house, the way that she sells that house to the girl is like how they list houses on Zillow.
Yes.
Or like apartments.
Yeah.
It's like conveniently located just outside the city.
Right.
When it's like 25 miles outside the city.
Cozy, which means tiny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Contractor's dream.
Oh,
which
yeah.
Which means
yeah.
used to be meth house.
Right. Needs to be gutted and or torn down. A combination experimental face clinic and dog hotel.
I think it's a good business model, personally.
Kennel your dog there while you get your face experimented on.
Yeah.
And then you both go home.
Exactly.
Yeah. A large...
If you think... You know how droopy dogs' faces get?
Are you talking about your own dog? And his recent experimental face surgery.
He is beautiful, just as he is, but he also has his own free will. If he would like to get a little touch up.
Didn't he?
Actually, he did.
Yeah. he has been experimental face surgery.
And he's loving it.
He looks beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tightened his eyes a bit.
Yeah. Lifted the mouth a little.
Got a couple of those wrinkles out of his face.
Yeah. He got a facelift.
Yeah, he looks gorgeous.
He's a beautiful boy.
Did you know dogs have eyelashes? You're right.
Nope. Yes.
Okay. Well, most people don't, and let me tell you, you're not going to miss my dog's eyelashes anymore because they are huge.
They're enormous. You'll also find a large open wound where the face should be.
Great description. Like that. I think that's a great I was watching this HBO show called The White House Plumbers, I think. Anyway, it's about the guys who broke into the Watergate Hotel.
Oh, okay.
And when they G. Gordon Liddy, who's one of the guys, is this like real wannabe secret spy guy, and every time they go to do something, his plan is always, he's like, Woody Harrelson's character is always saying, we need to be incognito. And G. Gordon Liddy's like, no, we need to be the opposite of that. So people will remember one completely garish detail about us that won't be our
God.
So like, he goes to do his thing and he's got this like bright pink shock wig on.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, well, they're not going to remember what my face looked like because they're only going to remember the wig. And that's the kind of thing where it's like, I don't remember anything about the guy that stole my car other than he had a giant open wound where his face should be.
One woman's ominously jaunty theme song.
Yeah, there's not a lot of music in this.
It's only when Louise is on screen and it's only that jaunty music.
The music, I think there's two like main themes, but they're very few and far between.
Yes. You will also find... Where am I? I lost my spot. The best disfigured face reveal after the Phantom of the Opera.
Very similar, too.
Yeah.
They do the kind of gauzed up.
Right. Like coming
lens.
Into focus moment. Yeah. A very dumb boy.
Yes.
Can't count fingers. What an idiot. A truly incomprehensible cop plot.
Yeah, we're going to get into that one.
Speaking of which, great value, Inspector Poirot.
Yeah, I couldn't, every time I saw the guy's name, it's, I don't know if it's Parrot or Poirot, it's P-A-R-O-T. I'm assuming it's Poirot.
I would guess.
Anyway.
So? No idea.
Not as good as
don't
the other
speak
guy.
French. Fair enough.
Actually, it's It would be like if in an Agatha Christie novel, Poirot did a little bit of investigating and then was just like, who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess we'll never know about this one.
Yeah, let's go get a drink. Yeah.
Graphic heterografting.
The heterograft is something that Republicans have been working on for decades.
They only support the heterograft.
Yes.
Canine justice.
It's really the best kind.
I agree.
Yeah.
I love canine justice. And yes.
Question. Mm. Canine Justice TV show.
Ooh.
Is it about a cop dog?
Mm.
Or is it a court show where the judge is a dog?
I want it to be the court show.
I think that's the better move.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah. Yeah. And last, but certainly not least, the triumphant return.
It's been a bit
of questionable parenting.
Questionable parenting.
Questionable.
Father who would do anything for his daughter, including
kill a bunch of girls.
Repeatedly cut off, reattach and
excuse
cut off
me,
her face.
Heterograft.
Excuse me.
He's a doctor. Let's get the terminology precise
here. Okay. Apologies again for my voice. It's coming back, but not quite.
Progress. Progress being made.
Eyes Without a Face is extremely French.
Yes.
It is it's extremely French in a great way, but it's watching it, I definitely found myself going like, yeah, this is like almost European to a parody level based on the jaunty music it starts with and the sort of disjointed not quite monologues, but, you know, gazing off into the middle distance.
Yes.
And
philosophizing about, you know, the nature of, is your daughter dead or is she alive?
Yeah. But
what really is death?
That being said, it's also a great movie.
Yes.
It's very cool. It's very creepy. That opening scene, as we kind of talked about a little bit, is very jarring because it does have this almost like circus music.
Yes.
This very upbeat, kind of jaunty is the only word I can think of.
Yeah. I keep coming back to it and feeling silly, but there's no other way to describe it.
It's a great tonal misdirect setup because it's kind of happy, whatever the word you want to use.
Sure.
And it's, you get these piece by piece kind of illuminating what the actual scene is, where it's a woman kind of driving a car looking stressed out.
Yes.
And then, oh, there's someone in the back who's incapacitated or indisposed in some way. And then you find out that person is dead. And then she throws the body into the river.
I love that setup because it's not a very long opening scene, but it does a few things very efficiently where it plays with your expectations as an audience member. When you see Louisa, and she's like not a super young woman, she's like a middle-aged woman, but she's very, very beautiful.
Yeah.
And you're seeing this sort of beautiful woman in this very anxious mode, right? Like, she's alone, it's nighttime. She's driving the car. She looks scared. She looks kind of nervous and like she's trying to hold it together. She's glancing in the rearview mirror a bunch. There's a strange figure in the backseat of the car, and there's another car or truck following them. So your instinct when you're watching a horror movie is, oh no, she's the victim, right?
Sure.
Like, either the person in the back seat is holding her hostage somehow, or the car behind them is chasing them, or something's happening. Here's this lovely looking woman in distress. And then it immediately pivots from that. If you look closely, when you realize that the body in the backseat is a corpse.
Yeah.
And you can get little glimpses of the face.
Could you? I couldn't.
If you look closely, not in like super detail, but there are just little between the brim of the hat pulled down and the collar of the coat, you can see that whoever is under there, that their face is very messed up.
Sure.
Yeah, and then it has her pulling over in the countryside next to a river and throwing the body in. And I love that as, like, this is how we're going to kick off this movie, with this kind of beautiful, like, she doesn't seem like a threat, right?
Right, yeah.
Because of both her, like, beauty and her age. So she's not really a femme fatale figure. but you know, yeah, she's out here and she's doing this thing. I just think it's great.
Yeah. I think it's a great opening. Mm-hmm. And it creates enough intrigue, mm-hmm, into what's going on,
yeah,
that just gets more and more interesting, as mm-hmm far as I'm concerned. But the thing that I found so unique about this is I was kind of thinking about it afterwards, and I was like, man, if this movie came out today,
mm-hmm,
would I like this movie? And the reason mm-hmm that I say that is because when you get to the end of this movie,
mm-hmm,
it's, there's like no resolution. It's like, mm, it's, there's some resolution, but not in the classic sense.
Yeah.
Right. There's a lot of stuff that kind of loose ends,
mm-hmm,
that they don't really resolve, but ultimately you kind of find yourself asking, I guess I should say, where most times when movies do that, you find yourself thinking about like a plot hole or, mm-hmm, or oh, they couldn't figure out how to do what X, Y, and Z. This one, it doesn't really feel that way because, yeah, the whole thing in general, the whole film has this sort of kind of, like you were saying, a ghostly, dreamlike, mm-hmm, nature to it. Like there's a big section in the sort of the middle of this, mm, that's just Christiane,
yeah,
walking around the house.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like every
silence.
Every,
yeah,
shot, I'm like, this is fucking awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a really tonally interesting movie because it kicks off with that opening scene in which, like, if you think about, you know, maybe like a decade or so later in Italy,
mm,
if this movie were a giallo,
yep,
you can see sort of some connective tissue between this and something like a giallo movie, but everything is inverted a little bit, where you've got like the kind of big coat, big hat figure in the back,
yep,
who turns out to be the victim, and the beautiful woman who would usually be the kind of like lightly sexualized murder victim throwing the body in the river.
If this was a giallo, though, the, yeah, title would be like, two big eyes, but no face for kissing.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. That sounds great. But do you know what I mean? Like there are a lot of trappings in this that you could trace into a bunch of Argento movies and things like that.
Where, oh, sure,
it's like,
yeah,
big countryside house, person killing beautiful young women for mysterious kind of weird psychological reasons.
Yep.
But in this, it's kind of done fully from the point of view of the perpetrators.
Yeah. Which is pretty unique.
Yeah.
Especially because, yeah, I usually when you have this kind of thing, it is kind of the main character would end up being that second girl.
Yes.
Who gets abducted.
Yes.
And when you discover what's going on, Christiane would be presented as much more ghoulish,
mm-hmm,
and the house would be much more of a labyrinth.
Yes.
Whereas this one, you're pretty familiar with the house. Like,
right,
like I said, there's a scene where Christiane's just kind of walking around through it.
Yeah.
And then you spend a lot of time with her,
yeah,
and she's, you basically get to see how depressed she is.
Right.
It's mostly about, like, for lack of a better term, a monster who's just depressed all the time.
Yeah.
And like just,
yeah,
tells her helper.
Yeah.
Just like, I want to be dead.
Stepmom, kind of.
Unclear.
Mother figure.
Yeah.
I would call her a mother figure at least. Yeah. I find the relationship between Christiane and Louise so interesting. Mm-hmm. And I find Louise such an interesting character on her own because you don't see many characters in horror movies, especially where it's like a woman who's probably like, I don't know, somewhere in middle age.
That woman was probably like 35.
But compared,
I know what you mean,
do you know what I mean? Like she's clearly not the ingenue.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But she's also not a matron.
Right.
So she's in this kind of pocket of womanhood that would usually place her in a...
Also, another alternate title for the Italian one.
Pocket of womanhood.
Pocket of womanhood.
That would usually place her only in like a motherly role.
Yep.
And she is, but she's not actually... She's a mother figure, but she's not a mother. Like, she and the doctor are not married.
Yep. She was 40 when she made this.
Yeah.
By the way.
Yeah. I think that we all don't want to admit it, but I think that counts as middle age.
It does.
But she's such an interesting character because I think she is both like extremely guilty and monstrous and lightly unhinged, but also very sympathetic.
Yeah.
Like, I think her devotion to the doctor and to Christiane is genuine. It's implied, or I think even outright stated, that she is a successful heterograft recipient.
Yes, but it seems to be neck related.
I think it was more, how did Christiane says, like, you still had a face. Like, you, your face was damaged, but you still had a face.
Sure.
Mine is destroyed.
Yeah.
So I think it was like he restored her features. I think the only evidence is the scar on her neck that she covers with this necklace. And she clearly feels like he gave her life back. And so she has devoted herself to him and his daughter.
Yeah.
Right? And her empathy towards Christiane seems very genuine. Like, it's very touching, the moments between them where she can look Christiane in the face without the mask on, and she doesn't flinch, she doesn't look away, she's very tender to her. Like, she tries to buoy her spirits and like encourage her, and she's bringing her food and she's brushing her hair. Like, they're very tender moments between them, but she's also the bait that lures all these other girls to their deaths.
Yeah.
And she has like zero regret about that.
Well, I don't think she thinks she's doing anything really wrong.
Right.
You know?
Right.
For you know, all the reasons that you were saying. I think she's, I think my favorite thing about this, other than the visuals, which are incredible.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Is that there's so much, and you could look at this in some places as maybe a negative. Towards the end, I think maybe this is a bit of a negative. But
okay.
For the main body of the movie, there's so much story that is not explicitly told to you.
Yeah.
That you are just getting through the actions and the interactions of the characters, which I think is awesome.
Yes.
Because that's when you can start kind of piecing these things together in your mind a bit. Mm-hmm. Like the relationship between her with Louise and Christiane.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of motherly, you know, is she, does she care about Christiane as a person, or does she care about her more as a, because she is the daughter of the doctor who she is clearly devoted to. You know, there's no flashback to whatever happened to Louise that caused her to need her surgery, or even Christiane's thing or whatever.
Yep.
And like, you get little bits that sort of explain certain things, but they never really go into it. Like the entire fact that the doctor is doing what he's doing, not because he's like, you know, some monster, well, he is, but not because he's this monstrous maniac,
right?
But it's because he crashed a car and smashed his daughter's face up.
Right.
And so he's obviously riddled with guilt and just wants to try and give her her life back.
Yeah.
And he can't. And it's like, it's that kind of stuff, which I find so interesting.
Yeah.
Even the stuff where it's like, she's calling her fiance.
Yeah.
And not talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know anything about their relationship.
Right.
I don't really care.
Right.
Like, they give you just enough to make it interesting.
Yeah.
Which is why, in the end, I feel like there's a bit more meat on the bone. Pun intended, I suppose. That they don't.
A bit more nose on the face. Yeah. They don't.
Yeah. I think there's a bit more that they could play with at the end there.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But they just sort of let the car roll into the river, sort of.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I have a lot of thoughts about the ending. So I'm going to hold those until we fully delve into that part of the movie. But one of the things I love about this movie is even the most monstrous of characters, the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone who's doing horrible things in this movie, none of them think what they're doing is wrong.
Right.
Right? Everyone genuinely thinks, well, this is what I have to do.
Yeah.
And like, this is just what I need to do next. And it's unfortunate, but we have to do it. Even, you know, when the first girl we see who's looking for the room. She's trying to find like a room, and they bring the Louise brings her out to the mansion, and she gets heterographed. Christian goes up, like sees her on the operating table unconscious before the procedure, and she goes up to her and touches her face.
Yeah.
And Christian, who's a very sympathetic character in the whole movie, she's very, even with the mask on, she's extremely beautiful. She's like moves in this almost ghostly or like ballet dancer kind of way,
yeah,
where she seems to float around and she just sort of like softly gestures at things and like touches things in this very, it feels like ballet watching it. And she does the same thing to this girl's face, knowing that her father is about to take the face off of this unwilling girl,
yeah,
and give it to her. And it's pretty atrocious that she'll go and like see her. Like Christiane is a willing participant in this to some extent.
See, until you said it, I forgot about that scene.
Yeah.
Because I was going to say, do you think that Christiane knows what's going on? And she clearly does.
She clearly does.
Which,
and it's happened at least one time before,
right,
Edna, who's the one we see get her face sliced off.
Right. And I think that is another thing that makes this a little different. Because even now, I think there's a good chance if they made this movie, Christiane mm-hmm. would be in the dark.
Yes.
Because the ending of this, I think one of the reasons that it feels kind of unresolved, and it's unresolved, but it's not unsatisfying.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a little unresolved because Christiane is not innocent,
right,
in any of this.
Right.
And she never faces any repercussions for anything. Maybe she does somewhere down the line.
She can't face it, Clay.
That's true.
It's really insensitive of you, actually. Well, I mean, if we're going to, like, I feel like maybe I should just talk about the end then, because I feel like we keep coming to it already.
Sure.
I think in the end, what you're seeing is how psychologically damaged she really is, where you get to a point where, you know, modern day, you'd make the argument, can she even be culpable, right?
Yeah.
Or is she so just like has the accident and the aftermath destroyed her mind enough that she would not be held competent, right? And I think that's a question you could debate, but I think her participation in the whole thing is why it has to feel sort of unresolved at the end. Because the implication through the whole movie is that her fate of being hideous now is a fate worse than death.
That's true. Yeah.
And so there's a way where you can look at this and say, isn't she punished enough at the end, where she's horribly disfigured? Her mother died before the movie even happened. She just murdered Louisa, who's the closest thing she had to a mother left. Her dad just got ripped apart by canine justice. She can never be with her fiance again, and she's kind of responsible for the death of these other girls.
Yeah.
So
on canine justice, the gavel, a bone, obviously.
Love it.
Continue.
Love it. We got to write this pitch. But I think kind of the only thing for her to do at the end is either to, you know, kind of drift off into the forest like some sort of fairy tale ghost or monster, or to die herself.
Yeah.
Like those are kind of the only options left. Like there's a version of this movie, if it ever got remade, where she is reunited with Jacques and he's I don't care if you're disfigured, I still love you. And then they ride off into the sunset together. But in this movie, I think because of her awareness of what's going on and her participation in it, she can't have a happy ending.
Yeah.
But at the same time, she is a victim too of her father's recklessness and his hubris. And so how much do you really want to see her get punished even more than she already
sure.
is?
Sure. And I think that's another thing that is so, let's just say, unique about the way things play out in this, because I think the more traditional way this movie goes is that Jacques discovers Christiane's alive, and that whole final sequence involves him trying to get to her, and you know, And he's like, oh, we should go. And then she's like, oh, we can't be together. And then she dies and the house burns down or something.
Right, right. He saves the other girl and then he ends up with her.
But in this one, Jock is like, I don't know. I thought I saw something, but I guess not. Yeah. And then he just disappears.
He just assumes. I really love that. I know I'm jumping around a lot, but I love that part of the... I wish the cop plot stuff made even a little bit more sense because I love the impetus for it.
Plot du gendarme.
Thank you. Yeah. I love the impetus for it because it's kicked off by, like you mentioned, she keeps calling him just to hear his voice. And finally, one time she calls him and she says his name. And it's so haunting the way she says it.
Yeah.
She sounds like a ghost. And he hears her over the phone and it triggers him to be like, maybe she's not dead. And I love that because he is still haunted by her, you know, dead or alive.
You're coming with me.
Right. Yeah, of course. But I love that because then the cops.
Robo gendarme.
Yeah. Yes. If he were there. Everyone would have been dead.
He would have shot that doctor right in the dick.
And all of those dogs would have been dead too.
It's true.
But I like that because it does give this like, it's a very gothic romance thing, right? Yeah. That he hears her voice and then he can't let it go. But then at the end, it is this sort of, for him, well, maybe it was just my grief. Maybe I'm still grieving her and I couldn't let her go. And I heard what I wanted to hear. And
Wuthering Heights.
There you go.
Is a story that I
Heathcliff
has existed.
It's me. It's Kathy.
Yep. Kate Bush. No, totally. I really love that sort of ethereal.
Yeah.
How she is kind of just a ghost through the whole movie.
Yeah.
Even to the point where it's like, you obviously this is not the case, but she is kind of almost presented as a person who doesn't actually exist.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But the thing with Jacques, and I guess we can get into this now. The thing with the cops is the most baffling. I don't even know what their plan was. And then they give up on it immediately.
Yeah. They sacrifice that poor girl for no reason. Like, I know she makes it out. She makes it out. But
when she gets picked up by Louise, I thought that was part of the plan.
Oh, really?
I thought the idea was like, okay, let's put her in this hospital. Mm-hmm. Then when she gets released, you know, maybe we'll see what happens. So then she gets picked up and then they follow her and that's how they figure everything out.
Right.
But her getting picked up was not part of the plan.
No, I don't know what the plan was.
I don't know. The plan was dye your hair blonde.
Yes.
And pretend to have like a concussion.
Right. Let them strap these light like thing this thing to your head and look at these lights for an afternoon and then I go home, I guess.
Yeah. And then when she leaves, they're like, oh, she never came home. Oh, shit.
Yeah. But even after that, they come and they look for her and they.
Yeah. And then they're like, let's go get a drink or something.
Right. They interrupt the heterografting.
Yeah.
Long enough for Christiane to have a change of heart. But that's it. Yeah, they don't. There's no, like, they have this girl's address.
Yeah.
Because she got picked up for shoplifting, which is how they, like, press ganged her into acting as
the bait. That's another thing, is this is one of those movies where there's nobody pure. Well, except maybe Jacques. He seems to be an all right dude. Mm. But, like, every character in this movie is a little slimy. Because those two cops, not the girls who get picked up, but. Yeah. Those two cops, when that first scene was like, I was sure that the conversation between the two cops was going to be like, you know, this is a misdemeanor, but you can get her to do whatever you want if you just pretend that she's going to have to go to jail, which is kind of what they do.
It's kind of what they do, but it's in a more quote unquote noble cause than them trying to blackmail her into like sexual favors.
Yeah, like I 100% thought that first scene with the younger cop and the girl was going to end with him being like, well, you know, maybe we should get together and we can find a way to talk
through this. Which Jalo movie is that from?
That's just Life.
Is that one?
I mean,
bird with a crystal
probably
plumage.
Most of them.
Yeah.
Because the cops are not usually very hard.
But there is one specifically that I'm thinking of where there is, oh God. Is it? I don't think it's bird with a crystal plumage. I don't think so.
I don't remember a lot of cop stuff from that other than bringing the perverts.
No, yeah, it's not that one. I can't remember which one it is. It's like the girl has been shoplifting and they bring her back into the office and then she agrees to give the guy her address and they let her go and then she gets like chased by a dog. Anyway.
I don't remember that.
I'll look it up later and everyone who listens to this podcast is screaming at us.
Kyle, let us know what movie it is.
Kyle, what am I talking about? Anyway. yeah, I don't know. I think this movie is kind of a weird world where if nobody is innocent, then nobody's guilty, kind of.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It really, I keep coming back to that feeling that everyone in this film thinks they're doing the right and only thing that they can do.
This is the events of this movie. It's very easy to heterograft a morality play onto this.
I really like using heterograft to just mean combine.
I had a roommate in college who tried to heterograft, but everybody could tell. That's actually not true. My roommate I had was actually very gay. And he was out and proud.
Good for him.
Hi, Evan. what was I trying to say?
Heterographed.
Nope. Yeah. This
morality plays.
Yeah, I think there's like, when I'm generating this, the normal way to do this would be X, it's very like traditional morality based.
Yes.
Where the doctor is evil.
Yep.
And Christiane can't. Christiane must be destroyed along with them because she has done it, you know, part of it. But this is, it's very much like there's no real, the stuff that the doctor is doing and the stuff Louisa is doing and the stuff that Christiane is party to is awful.
Yeah.
But it's never really presented that way. None of them. The movie doesn't make a judgment because I think they all, as you're saying, they all kind of have what they deem to be noble reasons for doing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it is also really a testament to what visual trappings can do for different characters where, like we were saying in a different and sort of more modern version of this, you go into the house, you know, you're more from the point of view of the victims, right?
Yeah.
And you finally get the scene in the house where the final girl is trying to escape getting heterografted. And she's running through the house. And the version of this movie in this world, the house would be like a crumbling mansion, right?
Yeah,
it would be like a shell of its once former beauty. And instead in this, it's like a very lovely and well-kept country home.
Across the street from an accredited clinic.
Right, where he's head of the clinic, right? And he is a very wealthy, famous, respected figure. He's giving public lectures on his new techniques in medical science, and he's very sharply dressed and well-groomed and well-put-together. He's very well-spoken, and there's the scene early in the movie where he is giving a lecture,
right?
And all of these society ladies are complimenting him afterwards and saying, my God, your techniques are the future, and da-da-da. And then you have Louisa, who's very, very beautiful and very polished and posh and very put together. And she seems very, like, even at the funeral, everybody's like, wow, she seems so affected.
Yeah.
Like, this has clearly hurt her, too. And even Christiane in her kind of eerie mask, again, she's very beautiful. She's doll-like and kind of lovely and delicate. And so you have all these people who are, like, physically charming, and they live clearly a rich lifestyle in a beautiful house, and so it becomes a lot harder to paint them just as like psychopaths,
right?
And monsters.
Yeah.
Like they're still integrated into society, and they're still performing like, oh yes, we clean the house, and we serve meals, and we sit down to dinner together, and we play classical music on the record player, and yeah, we're just high class fancy people.
Yeah, it's almost like what their face presents isn't what they actually are inside.
Eyes without a face.
English class. Pass.
I do. The actress who plays Christiane, I think she does such a great job of, even when her face is covered, like, the sort of like blankness of her face emotes.
Yeah.
Even without being able to really move it. And I know that's probably entirely due to her gigantic eyes.
Yeah. It's eyes without a face because there's not room on the for a face.
Right. It's all eyes all the time. But she does some great eye acting too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very unforgiving part.
Yeah.
And I think the casting was really great because she does have very expressive eyes.
Yep.
The first opening scene reminded me a little bit of the opening of The Invisible Man, where he's, you know, covered up in the jacket and the hat and everything. Mm-hmm. And it made me think of the reason that they cast Claude Rains, who was basically an unknown at the time, was because of his voice. Because this is someone you're not going to see for the entire movie.
Right.
And so you need to be able to project and act with the voice. And I think that's the same with this girl.
Yeah.
She clearly, they chose her because she could do a lot with her eyes and her body movements and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I think she's great. I like the scenes where she just wanders around the house, I find very, very riveting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just watching her move is like so spooky and so great.
It would be great if maybe I'll use AI and take
please don't
and take the girl from this movie and have her say the line Bane's lines from The Dark Knight Rises.
Why?
Because I mean that's just another great faceless performance by a great actor with a great voice.
You couldn't even put her in The Phantom of the Opera?
No, I want to hear her say, "Nobody cared who I was until I put on the mask."
That's your voice from now on, huh?
Christiane, what is... Doctor, what are you doing? Maybe he's wondering why you would shoot a man before throwing him out of a plane.
Okay.
This sounds like a winner to me.
You're wearing Bane's number one fan on your t-shirt right now.
We don't wear t-shirts. Us and the Bane fan club.
It's a singlet.
Yeah, it's a singlet or just a tactical vest.
Yes.
Speaking of masks, the mask is incredible.
Yeah.
I don't know if it is actually a mask or if it is some combination of mask and makeup.
Yeah.
When it is off her, it is clearly a mask.
Yeah.
But when it is on her face, it is so tight to her face that there has to be some movie magic built in there.
Yeah.
I thought maybe it was just makeup until later when she is actually talking.
Yeah.
You can definitely see that she's moving underneath it.
Yes.
So I don't know if it's just like really thin latex.
That's what I thought it was, that they must have made a mold of her face.
Yeah.
And then just made the thinnest possible latex and really smoothed it out.
It is so, I mean, maybe it's because she, not only does she have expressive eyes, but she's got very... sharply defined features.
Like yes.
When she does get the graft.
Yes.
Briefly.
Yep.
You know, you could see she's got a very pronounced cheekbone. She's got a very pronounced nose.
Yep.
And so, sanding that down a bit.
Yeah.
Still lets those things project through.
Mm-hmm.
So I think maybe that helps, that she does have fairly distinctive features.
I think it's also a little bit supposed to be how beautiful she really is. Because even when she does get the quote unquote successful heterograft, where obviously it is just finally the actress being able to walk around with her own real face, her features are very distinct, but her skin is like porcelain.
Yeah.
Even in real life.
Yeah.
Like she doesn't, there's not a wrinkle on her face. And so casting her makes that effect of the mask look even better, because even when she takes the mask off, her skin does look that smooth and that kind of perfectly like sanded down.
Yeah.
So even when she's out of it, her face still looks like the mask in a lot of ways. And so when she wears the mask, it doesn't look as jarring because it is kind of very close to, I think, her real face.
Yeah, but it does also have that weird uncanny valley effect that makes it that much creepier.
Yes.
And I did read, I don't know how true this is, I haven't heard him say it directly, but I did read that apparently that was one of the inspirations for Michael Myers' mask.
Yeah.
I can believe that, but I can also... Unless I heard him say that, I'd be like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Unless I listened to the interview where it was him.
Yeah, it kind of sounds a bit like one of those IMDb trivia things that someone just, you know, connected dots in their head. But I could very easily see him, John Carpenter, taking that cue from this movie.
Yeah.
It does go against most histories of the Michael Myers mask, which is like, yeah, we tried a bunch of other shit and then we just spray painted this white and that seemed to work. But, yeah, for a not only the mask but the surgery scene.
Incredible. Yeah.
I was joking last night when we were watching this. They show you specifically what they don't show you 40 years later in Face Off.
Yeah.
You know, it's 1960, so we're just kind of getting through the gore barrier. You know, Hammer's Dracula came out 2 years before this or a year before this. So we're just kind of bringing that stuff in. And you get like a pretty good full frame shot of him slicing her face. It's not just the slicing. It's Louise putting the clamps underneath
and
the
exposed.
And then when
he goes underneath with the scalpel and is like gently shimmying it around her skin to like very carefully peel it off of her face.
Yeah.
It's really well done. It'll definitely, if you watch it closely, it'll kind of make your skin crawl a little bit.
It's really great for 1960s special effects.
Yeah. And kind of unexpected in a movie like this where you get glimpses of the girls or Christian with their sort of destroyed faces, but the camera doesn't dwell on it.
Yeah.
And there's almost no blood in this movie.
Right. Yeah.
Like there's not a lot of blood and violence in this movie, and it really is kind of concentrated in that one surgery scene. And if they saved it all up for then, they did a good job. You know what I mean? Like that was the right choice to kind of, we're going to go all in on this surgery scene and make it kind of unexpectedly intense.
Yeah.
In this otherwise sort of dreamy and floaty movie.
Yeah, one of the things, excuse me. How about a throat without a cough, huh? One of the other things that I really like about the whole heterograft thing is it reminds me a little bit of, as much as I love the James Whale Frankenstein movie, one of the things that it did that we can't seem to get away from is every time someone makes a Frankenstein adaptation now, the creation scene has to go bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
When if you read the book, the creation scene is basically Dr. Frankenstein writing in his diary, I was up late one night and all of a sudden I realized that it started moving. Like there's some like allusion to some like things, but there's nothing specific about what he did or how he did it. And I really like that they kind of take that approach here where they're going to show you cutting her face off.
Right.
But aside from that, complete mystery what the heterograph procedure actually is. Other than just, what if we just plop this onto her face?
Yeah.
And hope it works.
Yeah. No, and you don't need it, right? Like all you need is you see the face removal and then the next day or whatever, this reveal of the now beautiful Christian.
It's like the opposite of Face Off.
Yes.
Where in Face Off, they have like a 5-minute sequence going through all the different CGI techniques of what's going to happen and all this kind of stuff, but they don't actually show the face removal.
Yep.
This one, it's like, no.
All face removal.
If we show the face removal, people will get there on their own.
Right, right. They kind of don't need the rest.
Yeah. Who wants to hear
a
treatise on... maybe he talks about it in that opening speech. To the people.
Yeah, the lecture. The lecture that he's giving. I don't think he goes into detail. I think he just sort of...
No, I mean like before we pop in.
I see. It's the part of the movie we didn't get to see.
Yeah. What is he doing with the dogs?
I think the implication is that he is doing skin graft experiments on them.
Yeah.
To try to refine his technique and make it even more seamless. Because mm-hmm. it's implied that he and Louisa are like bothered by the fact that she still has this tiny scar on her neck.
I think she's doing pretty good.
I mean, yeah,
all things considered. Yeah.
but it is kind of framed like she wears that necklace all the time to the point where it's such a defining characteristic that it tips Jacques off when he's talking to the police.
Right.
That the one of the girls who's gone missing was last seen with a woman who wore a very distinct pearl choker.
Yeah.
And so it's like a mark, even though she's has this beautiful, perfect face now because of the doctor. That little scar on her neck is seen as this piece of imperfection that she is embarrassed by, to the point that she keeps it covered. And when somebody tries to move the necklace, she kind of grabs it and stops them. So I think in this sort of deranged pursuit of perfection, the doctor is using the dogs to smooth out his technique and like reduce the scarring even further. So it becomes totally seamless when it heals.
Yeah. That explains the scene when he's standing over his daughter after mm-hmm. he's had to remove the graft, and he goes, mm-hmm. "Oh, Christiane, if only you had a snout. This would be so much easier."
Poor Christiane.
Yeah. Dad, why is my face so hairy?
Well, but I really think that the debate in this movie about is the doctor really doing this purely out of guilt and love for his daughter, or is it his own arrogance?
Yeah, it's a tough call, because I think, you know, when I said this movie is incredibly French, one of the things that makes me say that is that most of the characters are fairly stoic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if stoic is the right word. Like, Christiane is very emotional,
mm-hmm.
but she's not really affected by a lot. Like she's got that ghostly temperament that never really
kind of. Yeah, it's like depression and ennui, but it's not like nobody has a big emotion. The person who gets closest is Louise, who cries.
Yeah, and the doctor is very stoic. He's just kind mm-hmm. of like, my daughter will never have what we call a human face, and it like so you never really can sense what his true motivations are.
Right.
And I think it feels mostly out of guilt and wanting to help his daughter. I think they could have done like one little bit to show that he's like, if they wanted to show that, to make it more of a debate,
mm-hmm.
I think they could have shown something on the other side of the equation where it's like, you know, if he got mad that the graft didn't work or something and took it out, and, you know, something like that, where it's like the science aspect for that moment, you know, he fires up about, I don't know. But.
Yeah. I think I don't know. I kind of land on the side that I think it's, by the time the movie starts, it's definitely tipped into obsession.
Yeah.
And it's less about her happiness and much more about him being angry that he can't get it right.
Yeah.
Like, not angry at her, angry at himself and sort of at the procedure, because even there's a scene where Christiane tries to kind of say, I've had enough of this. And he gets mad at her. He's like, do you doubt my skills? I know my abilities. I know I can do it. And when I say I can do it, I will do it. Like, he gets very forceful about the idea that he's going to keep doing this until he gets it right, whether she wants a new face or not.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that's where it starts to tip into, he's kind of lost the plot.
Yeah.
If he's willing to just keep killing these girls.
I think he should have taken the win and been like, you know, Louise, maybe we got to start showing you off as a success. Unless the problem is he's only done it once.
I think that might be it.
And he can't repeat it.
I think that might be it. Or like he could do it with Louise because there was still native tissue to use.
Well, then maybe he's just aiming too high then. Because it's like.
But he needs to have a perfect daughter.
It's like him being like, well, thankfully we managed to fix your face, Louise, but I still haven't conquered how to reattach a severed head. It's like, maybe you take the W.
Right.
And then, you know, you bring that to the lecture, get more funding, and then you don't have to start stealing bodies.
And experimenting on dogs that people drop off at your countryside mansion slash hospital.
Yeah, at your farm in upstate.
Yeah. Aw. Poor dogs.
This movie did make me ask why women trust literally anybody in their lives.
It was a different time.
Is it though?
Well, I mean that is kind of a thing where that's, you know, the role Louise plays and why she's so pivotal and so important is.
If it was a man, they wouldn't get in the car probably.
I mean, maybe. You know, the thing you also have to remember is again, there's the class element of it, right? Like I was saying, these people are wealthy.
Yeah.
They're showing up well-dressed and well-groomed and clearly, you know, very well put together. The doctor is referred to as famous. He's referred to as rich and famous.
Right.
And so, yeah, maybe he's not doing it overtly because he's a recognized public figure. But if he is a well-known doctor who lectures around Paris, you know, a lot of people are going to be less up in arms about him because he must be a good man.
Yeah.
He has attained this place in society that kind of gives people an inherent goodness, especially, I think, in this time period where, you know, the attitude was still, well, if you were wealthy, you must deserve it.
Yeah. It did. There were a couple scenes in this that did seem like they were going to devolve into a really creepy three-way or something. Like when Louise brings the first girl all the way out to the house, which is way out in the sticks, and then like there's the doctor in his smoking jacket. I'm like, oh, this is going to be a sex thing.
Yeah.
Please don't call him Dr. Epstein. Call him Jeffrey.
I'm literally reading Ronan Farrow's book Catch and Kill right now.
Oh, yes. Which is all about fishing.
About Harvey Weinstein.
Oh, right.
And this was literally a ploy he was using throughout the like 80s and 90s and early 2000s, where you use a female employee to lure the woman you want to assault.
Right.
And make her feel comfortable because there's another woman.
It's the same thing Epstein did.
Yeah.
Not that I was there, but it's, you sounded as I've read,
very confident.
As I've read.
Yeah. Your friend Jeff.
When Jeff and I would talk.
Oh, God.
Listen, I didn't understand who he was when I got him on the inmate pen pal register, okay?
He signed his name Jeff. He spelled it G-off. I didn't think it was the same guy. Yeah.
Is there anything else we got to hit?
I could talk about this movie all night.
Yeah, it's really great. I mean, the more I think about it, the more I want to watch it again.
And there are some like unexpectedly beautiful shots.
Oh, the photography,
weird moments.
Photography's incredible.
It's just like, even one of the boring cop conversations early on in the movie, you're facing the sort of schlubbier cop. And then there's the older kind of slimmer guy who, I don't know if he was a cop or if he just worked at the morgue.
Mm-hmm.
But you're facing one of them, but he's standing in front of a big mirror. And so you can see the other guy he's talking to in the mirror behind him. So they're both facing the camera, but one is a reflection.
Right,
and
it's
such a clever, kind of like simple but clever shot. And it just looks so lovely the way everything's framed. And then there's a shot in the mausoleum when the doctor has slapped Louise across the face and she's kind of pressed against the wall of the interior of the mausoleum.
Yeah.
And it's covered in flowers. So it's just like her lovely face with a tear coming down after she's been slapped and all these flowers on the wall around her.
Yeah.
It's such a beautiful movie.
Yeah. And it does have a fantastic, we didn't even talk about the cemetery.
Oh, God.
Great creepy cemetery.
Great creepy cemetery. It looked like it's in purgatory.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's just in this like barren wasteland with like misty fields and weird trees. And a wall around it, and then there's nothing outside of it. It's great.
And I really like the mausoleum that they just open up the door, the trap door, just chuck the body down there.
That is how crypts work.
Yeah. I, you know, I never realized that. It took me a long time to realize that.
Really?
That I would always get confused by...
How are the children going to learn how to read if they can't even fit in the building?
Yes. No, yeah, but like it... I didn't frequent cemeteries like you did as a child.
Missed opportunities.
And so I've gone to more of them and seen kind of how they're designed, you know, later in my life. Mm. You know, just scoping out future plots.
Yeah, you got to know where you're going, man.
Yeah, man. Goals. Austria.
Austria, really?
Oh my God, it's so cool. The tombstones there are absolutely insane.
I think we missed that one.
Yeah. Mozart's buried there. Not really, but complete tangent here. But
we can talk about our favorite cemeteries anytime.
My favorite thing about the Vienna cemetery. Mm. So they used to bury people under the church, the main big church, right? But then too many people were in there, and so they had to build this cemetery so they could have a place to put all
classic
these bodies.
Classic European story about what to do with your dead people.
Right. However, people didn't want to be buried there because it was like uncool.
Yes.
Because why would you? Because it was outside of the city. It was outside of town.
Did they get a famous person?
They got many famous people.
Yep.
There's a whole section in the cemetery that are specifically famous people from Austria.
Yes.
Who were exhumed from their other place of burial and brought to Austria. So you could go like, oh, Beethoven's buried here?
Yeah, of course I want to go there.
I want to be buried here.
I recently read a book all about how this also happened in the United States.
And no kidding.
I forget who the name of the author, but the book is called Over My Dead Body, and it is sort of a history of American cemeteries.
That's kind
of
fun.
And it was pretty good. It's a quick read. Each chapter highlights like a big, like famous cemetery that was sort of either a turning point in how we conceived of burial in this country, or how cemeteries were designed. So like Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge is one they talk about because it's one of the sort of like nature based cemeteries that kicked off that big trend of having it be more like a park with like ponds and trees and things.
Of the things that I find fascinating about that is how burial rites were so generally like revered and taken so seriously and so special until World War One, and also to like the Civil War in America, War, when it was like there were just so many bodies, they just couldn't do funerals.
It's
for
like
everybody.
That in plague times, where they're just like throw them in, get rid of them.
Yeah. Yep. It also, the things you learn the longer you live and the things that just like
and the
occur
more
to
you get into dead people,
the things that just occur to you, right? Like, you know, you go to a funeral, there's flowers are beautiful, yada, yada, yada. I was at a funeral not that long ago and I'm just sitting there and I just went, oh my God, the flowers are so the body doesn't stink.
Yeah.
Like it was, it's something that obviously they did back before they could embalm people. And they just use that to cover the dead of it all.
Yeah. There's a whole theory about the reason why we call them living rooms.
Really?
Yeah.
That would make sense.
We used to present, like when somebody died, you'd die in the home.
Yeah.
And so then your sort of parlor or whatever would become the room that you would present the body in.
Yeah.
And that's where you would have it when people would come to visit, pay respects before the actual burial. And once dying at home kind of fell out of trend, I guess you would say, and became less normal, it was like, well, how do we like remarket this room of the house so that people will think of it differently? And they started calling it a living room rather than the dead room, I guess.
Dead room, yeah. Have you ever been to a funeral in a house like that?
No.
Doesn't happen that often anymore, I think. Yeah. I've been to one.
Mm.
It was kind of weird.
I bet.
You walk in, here's the kitchen, then you go, oh, casket.
Right. It's funny. I feel like it still happens in movies all the time, though.
Yeah, I did learn from Road to Perdition that they used to literally put bodies on blocks of ice, which is fun. Mm-hmm. But anyway, what are we talking about?
This has been Corpse Corner with Clay and Amanda.
But no, like, I won't go into my confusion about how mausoleums work, but
I think we can all kind of extrapolate.
Yeah.
We all probably had similar levels of confusion the first time as like a kid or a teenager you thought about a mausoleum for more than 30 seconds.
I was thinking about fun stuff as a teenager or a kid, okay?
Yeah, like mausoleums.
Like pogs.
What's a... Oh, yeah, those things?
Yeah.
Anyway.
The cemetery looks cool.
Yeah.
Is there anything else?
20-minute digression later about cemeteries.
I think we should probably wrap it up.
Yeah,
the one thing I did want to mention is that...
I feel like I'm holding everyone hostage at this point.
Hey, I started the cemetery talk. This was
you have no idea how much I'm restraining myself.
Oh, no, I do. this movie was originally released in the U.S. by Lopert Pictures in 1962 in an English-dubbed and heavily edited version titled The Horror Chamber of Dr. Faustus.
I feel like that should be a Vincent Price movie.
Yeah, an odd title considering there is no character named Dr. Faustus in the film. Mm. They also, when they were starting to make it, the producer advised the director that there shouldn't be any violence towards animals because that would upset Britain.
Okay.
There shouldn't be any gore because that would upset the French censors.
Oh.
And there shouldn't be any mad scientists because that would upset the German censors.
Ah.
Also, kind of hilarious that the Germans saw mad scientists and were like, you're making fun of us.
We feel personally attacked right now.
It's funny because it's true. What can I say? Anyway, I think that's going to do it. We're going to hit the... Oh, placement. It's number 20.
Hmm. I don't hate it.
I kind of respect it.
Yeah.
I don't think it would be my first choice.
Yeah.
But seeing it there go, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Yeah, yeah. I think I feel the exact same way where would it be my personal number 20, my knee-jerk reaction for number 20? Maybe not.
Yeah.
But if I saw it there, if I see it on this list or someone else's personal list, if it was at number 20, I'd be like, oh, cool. I love that movie.
It's a more obscure movie that if I saw it on the list, like on the second, on the back end of 200.
Yeah.
The very crowded back end of 200.
Yeah.
I'd go, well, I think that should be higher.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is definitely one that feels that.
Because I do think it had a big impact on a lot of directors and filmmakers who came later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's going to do it for Eyes Without a Face. We're going to hit the randomizer button. Beep, boop, boop, beep, boop, boop, beep, boop. And we're going to, we're going very, very high up on the list.
Oh.
And I think this is going to be the start of looking at some of these highly ranked movies and really having to repress the part of me that goes, who the fuck put this at number 8?
Oh, boy.
Because we're doing number 8. It's a movie called The Loved Ones.
Oh.
Which is from, it's a movie I have heard of but never seen.
I've never even heard of it.
I believe it's like a Canadian slasher movie or something.
Okay.
I'm sure it's great, but it's going to be real difficult for me, unless this is legitimately a masterpiece.
Yeah.
To be like, number 8. Yeah. I think that makes sense.
So what you're saying is you're ready to have your mind blown.
Always. Always. Yeah, it's number 8. This website is so messed up.
Eesh.
I don't know why. Did they do this specifically to spite us?
Probably.
After a classmate declines her invitation to the school dance, a teenager kidnaps him and makes him the guest of honor. So it sounds like a tie your boyfriend to a chair, put a drill in his face. At least that's what she's doing on the cover. Anyway,
all right.
So we'll see.
We'll find out. We'll go on this adventure together.
Don't let our intense enthusiasm stop you all from watching the film.
I'm curious. I mean, I've never even heard of it, so I'm open-minded.
This is what we're here for.
Yes.
But that's going to do it for us. If you want to help support the show, head over to patreon.com/thepenskyfile, where, as I said, you can follow us as we get into sequels this year. And every time we do one, I go, oh my God, there's another month gone in the year. And it's moving too fast.
I thought you were going to say an angel gets its wings.
Yeah, I wish. thank you guys for supporting the show. Thank you, Amanda.
Thanks, Clay.
See you next time.
Bye, everyone.